ruthless invaders, a defenseless planet. Battle beyond the stars. A lone youth escapes on a last-ditch mission that begins at the edge of the universe.
Oh, no.
The story of a boy who finds more than he expected.
Make them burn.
And all he can handle.
Does your species have kissing?
Oh, yes. We have that.
Battle beyond the stars.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the B-Movie Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Kautzer, and we are in the midst of an ongoing series for the month of December, Star Wars-ish, where we're looking at films that were either inspired, homaged, or just outright ripped off in some cases, Star Wars. Not the entirely the Star Wars series, but the 1977 George Lucas seminal film, of course. And why are we doing this? Why are we going and deep diving into a bunch of sci-fi madness? Well, it's because, as you probably know, unless you've been under a rock or in a coma or just generally outside of the universe, December 15th, Rian Johnson's written and directed The Last Jedi is being released or unleashed onto the world. So in honor of that momentous occasion, we decided to talk about a bunch of sci-fi films this month, kind of end your B-movie podcast year with a bang. And we've got some great stuff lined up for you guys. As you probably already can tell, we've started off with a bang with Star Wars-ish Wackadoo, where we looked at Jupiter Ascending in 3D by the Wachowskis, and then Flash Gordon, Mike Hodges' deranged, lunatic, amazing 80s reimagination of Flash Gordon by way of Star Wars, which Star Wars is already a reimagining of Flash Gordon, so there's all kinds of meta-ness on that one. You can always go back and to our back catalog and take a look at both the or listen to both these episodes. I guarantee you will have a good time, and I will try to make my case to convince you to see both of these films. One, Flash Gordon, probably the easier one that you probably have already seen. Jupiter Ascending. Maybe a little bit tougher, but I think I make a really good case for it because it's a lovely, lovely, beautiful film, and it just fucking rocks. So with that, we're changing it up. We're going, this week's double feature is titled Star Wars-ish, The Magnificent However Many. And what we're doing is actually looking at one of the films that inspired George Lucas to make Star Wars, and it's also a personal favorite of mine, which is The Seven Samurai, and we're looking not at that movie, but we're looking at movies that used the Seven Samurai story structure and created a Star Wars-like adventure. So first up, we have Battle Beyond the Stars, and then next after that, we have Crawl. So we'll be talking about both of these. Before we get into this, though, I do want to just, like, you know, acknowledge something. You probably see it in the show notes. I just want to give a shout-out to Junk Food Cinema, who they are a podcast that I try to continually not program things that they've covered. And in this case, it was something that I know that they had covered it way early in their lifespan. Love those two episodes. I just want to give a shout out to them and acknowledge that these were two of three films that Cargill, one of the co-hosts of B-Movie or the Junk Food Cinema, which if you don't know who Cargill is and you don't know Junk Food Cinema, you got to listen to the podcast. There's a link in the show notes. Go ahead and download all their episodes. They are amazing. Him and Brian Salisbury, who host this podcast about exploitation films, very similar to the B-Movie Podcast. So they, Cargill had dubbed these two films along with a third film, his trilogy of James Horner scores that he would put on and listen to the score and watch the movies because he liked them. I am also a kid of the 80s and love James Horner and have seen these films a whole bunch, just as much as Cargo. I don't know if I, like, anybody has a love of these movies the way that Cargill does, but it's all to say that I definitely wanted to mention that and throw that out there, because they definitely deserve credit because they were there first, and I just felt disingenuous if I didn't do that. But with that being said, let's just get right the fuck into Battle Beyond the Stars. Directed by Jimmy T. Murakami and written by John Sayles and Ann Dyer. Now, the film, as I mentioned before, literally takes the structure from The Seven Samurai and places it in a Star Wars-like context where it's a space adventure. So basically you have an alien race coming to this peaceful planet that is populated by the Akir. Yes, Akir as in Akira Kurosawa. Yes. This is something that we, like, you know, John Sayles, one of the best, if not possibly the best B-movie writer ever. I would put it into contention between him and probably Larry Cohen. Like, they're probably neck and neck. I don't know. Like, for volume, it probably is Larry Cohen. But for quality, I might say John Sayles. I mean, I have a preference for John Sayles. That's just me, though. But he takes this structure that Seven Samurai has of an invading alien, like, you know, an invading force. This time, instead of it being like a gang of bandits, it's an alien race headed by John Saxon, John motherfucking Saxon, playing an alien that is come to live for a very long time because he takes parts of other aliens and Frankensteins that shit onto him. His whole entire crew are a race of men and women, are basically men that replace, like, you know, their different body parts so that they can live essentially forever. And so basically he plans to take all of their, like, all of their resources in 7 days. And so the town folk, being who they are, can't fight against this vastly superior power. So they go and look for mercenaries. And the person tasked to look for these mercenaries is Shad, played by Richard Thomas. Richard Thomas, a.k.a. John Boy, and he plays a farm boy with dreams of more, you know, Luke Skywalker, farm boy too. The structure, like I said, follows Seven Samurai to a T, where he finds all of the various various alien races that come together to form this group that's going to fight against Sador and his minions, and hopefully, save the day. It's very straightforward. I mean, but there's a beauty in how straightforward it is and the way that Sayles writes the script. I mean, this script is, like, don't be fooled the fact that it's a Roger Corman film, that, you know, it has some goofy moments. This movie is a hell of a written movie. Like, Sayles just knows. It's just like Piranha. Like, he took Piranha, which was basically supposed to be a Jaws ripoff, and turns it into one of the best low-budget films of all time. He gave Roger Corman, for a certain period, some respectability because of how good his scripts were for the work that he did for Corman. And Corman went full hog on this one. It was the biggest budgeted film that he ever produced. It at $2 million back in, 1980s money or 1979 when it was, 1980. And it just shows. It shows that they cared. Like, I think that people that have not seen Roger Corman produced films often think that because they are low budget, that means that no one had cared and that they're all schlock and junk. That is not the case. Corman films, even though they were low budget, they were never, I mean, they may have been schlocky too, but a lot of them were well-made, just low budget features. Now, of course, Corman was like one of the cheapest producers ever, that ever stepped foot on Hollywood, and he would shortchange you at every turn, but he gave his directors freedom. He gave his writers freedom to come up with whatever could sell, as long as it had some violence, it had some sex and nudity, he could sell it, or horror and gore, he could sell it. So, I mean, we haven't talked a lot about Roger Corman, but I feel like this is the perfect movie to talk about Corman in just showing that, yeah, it is a crass Star Wars ripoff. But if you get beyond the surfacey things of the film, or the surfacey like coincidentals, what you get is this really great action adventure movie that has some really awesome, unique aliens, storytelling tropes. I mean, there's a lot that's going on in this film that goes beyond just your average sci-fi film. Like, people really did care when they were making this film. It's not like a fly by the seat of your pants, even though it was filmed and produced as a fly by the seat of your pants film. And again, like, you have guys like, I mean, you know, the cast. Let's just look at the cast. You have Richard Thomas, Robert Vaughn, who, of course, you know, comes in because he was originally in the American remake of Seven Samurai, The Magnificent Seven. John Saxon, George Papar, Sybil Danning. I mean, you've got these great actors, or these really well-known actors in, like, you know, bigger parts. It's not like George Peppard is not in this movie at all. Like, he doesn't show up for 2 seconds and then is gone. I mean, he has a hefty role, and you gotta just love Peppard's character is named Space Cowboy. That's it. And he's from Earth. And he talks about these, like, you know, he talks about Westerns. He talks like about like Western history or Western frontier history. And Peppard is just eating it the fuck up. Just eating it up. Like you almost expect him. You have expect him to at a certain point just to wink at the camera and just say, yeah, I took the money, but I'm having a hell of a time in this fucking movie. Robert Vaughn is the same way. Like, Robert Vaughn actually ellipses anybody in this film as Gelt, the assassin that's looking, that's so dangerous that, and has crossed so many people that he is literally on a planet abandoned by himself with riches, untold fortunes, and literally his back is against the wall. Like, he is essentially has nowhere to turn. And if he gets out of his planet, he's going to die because there's so many people that want him dead. And he knows that this is his last stand, but he just wants some place where he can get a hot meal and not worry about being assassinated. And that's why when Shad comes to him, he accepts his terms, because he wants to belong again. It's really interesting, because it's the storyline of the assassin that is out, or the gunslinger that has aged out, but is just tired and weary. And Vaughn plays it so well. Like, when I remember when I was a kid watching this film, I always felt that Vaughn was just felt like he was bored. But when you watch it now with like like when I watch it now, and I started when I was watching, when I had seen it again in my 20s, the thing that struck me was, it wasn't that Vaughn was just bored and he wasn't playing anything. He was just playing a man that was resigned to the utmost weariness of world weariness. In a lot of ways, it's kind of funny, because when I saw The Force Awakens, the Han Solo story arc for The Force Awakens completely reminded me of the Gelt storyline with Robert Vaughn. A man who's like, you know, who just wants to go out like a warrior, or doesn't want to die alone. And like, spoiler for a close to 40-year-old movie, Robert Vaughn's death scene in this movie is just, it's heartbreaking and it's horrifying. I mean, there's some stuff in this movie that's just truly like there's no way that they would get away with it in a PG movie nowadays. Like the whole thing of the thing that I'm thinking about that always shocks me. Like, I was sitting, me and my girlfriend Christina were watching this movie, and she always just inactively watches it whenever I watch something like this. But there has to be something that really hooks her in order for her to like kind of pay attention. And the moment where Sader's goons are in a ship and they decide to decide to disrupt a wedding, like, you think in a PG movie that they're not going to imply anything other than that they're going to kill the bride and the groom. No, this movie, and Sales goes for it. He knows that you need to show how rotten these people are, and basically they kidnap the bride. And the same, like the way that it was in Seven Samurai, this was a story point in Seven Samurai where these men just brutalize this young bride, and it's mortifying. Like, it literally just kind of shocks you. Is it a dirty trick? Yes, it is. But in the hands of somebody like John Sayles, it's never salacious, and the way that it ends is so just kind of stark. It's very stark, but it's like these kinds of touches that Sayles puts into the movie. Like, there's that. There's the way that Gelt's death scene. Nestor. There's a moment with Nestor, who's the like hive-minded alien that all look the same, even though they're slightly different. They're all in white. They're one of the peoples that they're one of the mercenaries that Shad finds and take on his cause. And there's a moment where they sacrifice one of their own to see if they can get rid of Sador. And it's not just like good Stark writing, but it's good, clever writing. Like, all of this stuff is clever. Like, when you watch this film, if you've never seen it before, the thing that will be continually going through your mind is that, wow, this is a lot of fun, but it's also really clever. And that solely has to do with the script by John Sayles and Ann Dyer. There's a, and we'll get to this in later, there's a commentary between Corman and Sayles, and it's a great commentary. It's a really great commentary that I highly recommend everybody listen to, and we'll get to the details of that in a moment. But it's a really, really well-constructed film, and Murakami, like, you know, he knows how to direct it. Like, that's the thing, is that what always fascinates me is, are the Corman directors, the difference between the guys who did nothing and the guys who, like, you know, became Jonathan Demme, Martin Scorsese, Joe Dante. It all is really interesting to me how some of these directors really hit it big and other ones did not. Murakami is one of those guys that that I'm always interested. I was always interested in. He recently passed away a couple of years ago, unfortunately, but he never really hit it big. Like, I think the biggest thing that he had done was the animated BBC Chronicles of Narnia. He did that, and then I cannot remember if he had. I think he had done he did another animated movie, which was A Christmas Carol, but not the, like, this one was back in like 2001 or 2002, yeah, I mean, those are his biggest things. Like, there was not a lot of, he did Humanoids of the Deep, which got him the job for Battle Beyond the Stars. But it's really interesting to me that even though when you watch it, it's a very well-directed film, that no one bothered to hire him beyond that, which is completely interesting to me. It's pretty straightforward, but it's really badass. Like, I love it. It's like one of those films, and I mean, Cargill is right. The score fucking kicks ass. Like, I think that a lot of the affection for this film and the forgiveness of some of the effects work, which we'll get to in a moment, is because of just how good the score is. I mean, after this, like, you, when you listen to that score, it is a James Horner special. But imagine, this is his first score. Like, I mean, I can't even compare it. This is kind of similar to, this is on par to, like, say, Michael Giacchino, with his Alias score, and how, like, Alias and Lost, and how, like, he just kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, he didn't come out of nowhere, but Horner, same thing. I mean, just an amazing fucking score. And I mean, so much so that Corman reused the score multiple fucking times. In fact, there's a movie that we're going to be talking about in a few weeks that the score and the special effects are taken directly from Battle Beyond the Stars. And those effects, I think it's pretty well known at this point. The effects were actually done by James Cameron. Like, he was the special effects supervisor, which means basically he did all of the effects work. I mean, that's what it meant on a James Cameron film. If you were the effects supervisor, you did everything yourself. Cameron, the most amazing part about this film is that Cameron did some of these tracking shots, these effect shots, with no motion control cameras. Now, anybody who knows anything about special effects, especially model effects in camera that are done in camera optical, like Star Wars before the special editions, know that you need a motion control camera. You need a computer operated camera so that when you do multiple passes, which is required for effects work, that those multiple passes are done exactly the same way. Now, Cameron didn't have a motion control camera because, I mean, you know, fucking, Roger Corman, save a buck. If he could save a buck, he could, and he would, and he would shortchange you on production. I mean, that's just, mother is the, what is it? Desperation is the mother of invention or something like that. Something along those lines. But you watch this film and realize that Cameron does all of these shots that track around ships, model ships, with no motion control camera. That's fucking impressive. And that just kind of tells you, even at that early stage, 4 years before he would write and direct The Terminator, the kind of drive and perfectionism that Cameron actually has embedded inside of him. And this is also the film that Gail Ann Hurd and James Cameron met. She was actually the line producer on the film, and he was, of course, the effects supervisor. They met and, you know, bore the fruit of a very successful marriage for a time, and some of the best movies of the 1980s, best sci-fi action films of the 1980s. So there is always that, but it's... It goes without saying, when you watch this effects work and you realize that Cameron had little to no, little to no like money to produce these things, it's pretty amazing. The funnier thing to me is the fact that Corman loved it so much and thought that they were so good that he recycled them at least 5 different times. And again, this effects work is going to show up in another film that we're going to be talking about in a few weeks for this series. So hang tight on that one. It's going to be pretty fun. It's going to be pretty fun talking about that one, and then talking about like how that's a Corman special along with the score. This film has actually been released by Screen Factory on a Blu-ray and DVD. I recommend the Blu-ray because it's got a great transfer. And again, I know that a lot of people think that Corman films, because they're low budget, that the quality of the image might be lesser or anything, and that's not the case. I mean, he's shot on 35, always shot on 35. And it's just, we're lower budget films. This film, the restoration work that Shout Factory has done for this disc that's been released for a couple of years now is great. And they've got some really good special features, a making of that's like about an hour long that just goes over the effects process and all they did. They didn't get James Cameron, but they got everybody else to talk about the film but him. But then they have 2 really great commentaries. The commentary by Roger Corman and John Sayles is probably one of my favorites. It just like literally one of my favorite commentaries of all time. And it's because Sayles and Corman kind of just lift the veil of what Corman does and production anecdotes. And they seem like genuinely they're genuinely have affection for one another, which I love. I mean, I'm a huge John Sayles fan. In 2018, I think that we're going to kind of do what we did with Walter Hill with John Sayles, which is to say that we're going to highlight him as a filmmaker, because I think that not enough people talk about John Sayles. So we're going to have quite a few episodes that are going to be dedicated to John Sayles. It's in the works. And this is just the beginning, a preview of what you're getting. So just something to look out for and be aware of. But that commentary is great. And then there's an additional commentary by Gail Ann Hurd, who actually... does an entire commentary, and it is really great. She goes into she basically goes into like all of the production and all of the different troubles that are associated with the Corman film, and like, you know, both commentaries are really honest, but they're highly entertaining, highly entertaining, and I definitely suggest that anybody who is like, you know, who's not seen this film, give it a shot. Just check it out, seriously. And with that, you guys can reach out to us on Twitter and Instagram. The handle is BMoviePod, the letter B, the word movie, the word pod. All together, no lines, no dashes, no bullshit. You can read my work and the work of our and my colleagues on filmdispenser.com. We have a sister written column that I write, the B-Movie Aisle, where we look at different boutique labels, releases, and kind of highlight them on the home video format. This week, we have a couple of different items that are going to be dropping if you're listening to this in real time. So check out for that. And again, as always, I just want to thank everybody for listening. Your listenership on this really strange and wonderful journey that we're taking into, as we call it here, B-Movielandia. It's the juice that pushes us forward. And I love you guys all. It's the holiday season, so I'm going to get a little mushy. I haven't watched the Royal Tenenbaums yet, but I'm due to, and I'll fucking cry my eyes out, and I'll probably get mushy about that. And I get a little bit mushy around this time of year, but I do honestly want to say that you guys are the butter for my bread. You guys keep this strange journey that we're on going, and I love all the interaction that I have with you guys. You guys DMing me or, you know, posting on Twitter. Please continue to do it even more so. I'm more than willing to talk and, you know, engage on any B movie. It doesn't matter. I mean, fuck, if you like Twilight, let me know. If you don't, then don't. But it's all to say, guys, this is all because of you guys, and I really appreciate it. So we'll be back next time with Kroll. And I can't wait to talk about Kroll, because Kroll happens to be one of my favorites. So until next time, talk to you soon.